This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Jeremy Alford, the editor and publisher of Law Politics, and much going on in our state in the political realm with a U.S. Senate race. 1 month from tomorrow, the election is. Mary Landrieu seeking a fourth term. We'll talk about that. Also, Bruce Greenstein, the former Secretary of Health, indicted. Does this spell bad news for Governor Jindal and his quest for the White House? And Scott Angell in the race now for Governor of Louisiana. Also, financial analyst Andy Anderson on the stock market's prospects, Wall Street in the fourth quarter. And we're slated to hear from two-time National Book Award winner Catherine Patterson, who's coming to our community. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. Frank Barnett is producing, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, or tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Our guest to begin is Jeremy Alford, the editor and publisher of Law Politics, and this has been a busy week amid many busy ones of late as we head to the finish line with a U.S. Senate election 1 month and 1 day away. But yesterday, the spotlight was on next year's governor's election, and when I say next year, we're talking one year from this month, a primary, which right now has four very well-known Louisiana politicians, and it may get more crowded, but Scott Angell, you broke the story. The public service commissioner is officially in the race.
Right, and I think it was one of the worst-kept secrets in Louisiana politics over the past year that Scott Angell was looking to run for either lieutenant governor or governor, and I think within his circle of friends, he was bouncing back and forth a bit, but, you know, at his age, at this point in time, I think he's just one of those Louisiana boys who grew up, you know, their heroes have always been governors, and it's time to run for him.
Their heroes have always been cowboys, but in this case, the governor's office is the plum. Although for Bobby Jindal, as we found out, it's more or less a way station for him.
Yeah, yeah, he spent more time in Rhode Island than he did on Avery Island, that's for sure.
You're good. That's a good line, but that is true. Bobby Jindal, who went to college in Providence, Rhode Island, has been in places away from Louisiana more frequently than any previous governor. He is running for president of the United States, and next year he will be succeeded by somebody, and there are four familiar names. And right now, I guess of the four, if Governor Jindal would be closest to one of the four, it's probably the guy who got in the race yesterday.
That's really interesting, right? We've seen Democrats statewide and even on the local level over the past couple of years have had the stone of being associated with Barack Obama around their neck. And now all of a sudden, any candidate with any kind of relationship with Bobby Jindal is starting to be called out. You know, in the 6th Congressional District, there are questions about Garrett Graves, his former coastal advisor, whether he was close to him. Zach Dasher in the 5th Congressional District, his family's very close to the Jindal family. He's got some of Jindal's folks working on his team. And now Scott Angell, and I think Angell's got to be sitting back and watching these elections with interest to see if Graves and Dasher do get pinged with this pretty hard. Because if he does, if they do, you know, he's going to have to work that into his campaign model. But I would say that Scott Angell is in a bit of a better position possibly because, you know, his years with Jindal is just one chapter in a larger book. He did work for Governor Blanco before that. And he's been on his own largely, even though he was appointed to LSU Board of Supervisors when he left the general administration.
Appointed to a governor by.
Right, and to a water commission as well.
So, yeah, so his links to the governor are indisputable. And the other three candidates, it goes without saying, John Bel Edwards is not in Jindal's camp. They're in different parties. Jay Darden has never been a favorite of the governor. And David Vitter, who under ordinary circumstances would be an ally, those two don't like each other.
No,
that's kind of the untold story. They really don't like each other.
Right. They've always been at odds over this or that. And I think Vitter, when he declared for governor, took a pretty clear shot at Jindal, saying that he'll stay in Louisiana. This is the job he wants. It'll be his last job if he gets it. So he was clear, made a point to define himself as a candidate and as a governor that would be different from Jindal.
Mm-hmm. And Jindal, of course, succeeded Bitter in the congressional district down in the New Orleans area. So Bobby Jindal, despite growing up in Baton Rouge, is actually on the elective front. He's a Republican from Kenner. Kenner.
That's right. He
moved. Bobby Jindal. 297-5633 for Jeremy Alford of La Politics and Scott Angel in the race now officially for governor, and he will be a formidable candidate. He's public service commissioner, former lieutenant governor, former secretary of the Department of Natural Resources under two different governors, and he's from Acadiana. So there's no doubt he has a base. I would say he starts with 10%. And if he gets to 20 in a crowded field, he might be in a runoff.
I think you're right. I think if he galvanizes the parish presidents and the sheriffs from the Texas line up to Baton Rouge, uses his oil and gas contacts to move into North Louisiana where there is no candidate, I think you're right. I think he starts off with 11, maybe 12%. The rest of the to make up the difference to get in the runoff, he's going to need some breaks. He's going to maybe need some more Democrats in the field. He's going to need maybe a backlash against Vitter for the amount of money he's spending, and he's being aided by a super PAC. But the other aspect that helps Angel stand out from the field is this stylistic approach that he has. You know, he's a fiery speaker. He's a grab you by your lapel speaker. He is quick with Cajun jokes. He's not afraid to be self-deprecating. And when you compare that to the kind of the button-down approaches of David Vitter, John Bell Edwards, and to a much lesser mm-hmm. extent, Jay Darden, I think that could resonate. And you look at Edwin Edwards' 1971 run for governor. Think about Mike Foster's 1995 run for governor. I think a rural Cajun lawmaker could make a rural Cajun candidate, rather, could make a real go of this campaign.
297-5633 is your number for Jeremy Alford, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Crystal notes that when he was running for public service commissioner, Scott Angel defended Governor Jindal's refusal to take the broadband money, about $70 or $80 million in particularly North Louisiana. That shows, according to her, his close ties to this administration. That's the kind of question he'll be asked on the campaign trail, I'm sure.
I would say repeatedly, and it's already started. John Bell Edwards' first statement about Angel's announcement was that he's stood up for the governor's policies, whereas John Bell said he's always questioned the governor's moves. But there's no doubt there's a number of ties that bind Angel to the governor.
And as we look at the race right now, we've got John Bell Edwards. He was first up, Democrat, and the only prominent Democrat who is in the field right now. And we've got three prominent Republicans in U.S. Senator David Vitter, Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden, and now Public Service Commissioner Scott Angel. With the field as it is now, it would seem that if that stayed the way it is, the likely runoff would be John Bell Edwards against a Republican, who would then be the favorite.
Right.
It's very similar to what we're seeing in the 6th District right now with Edwin Edwards and an array of Republicans on the other side, and one of them will be the favorite, the heavy favorite, to win the election.
Right. I'm not convinced the field is settled, though. A lot of folks are encouraging Mayor Mitch Landrieu to get in. If he does, I would say that sucks the wind out of not only John Bell Edwards' campaign, but probably Angel's as well. Also, on the Republican side, Treasurer John Kennedy is said to be seriously considering the race. At the very least, he has not ruled it out. So we could see a few more people pop into mm-hmm. this race.
Kennedy is going to be 63 years old next month. It would seem that this is perhaps his last shot, and he has always wanted to be governor of Louisiana. So, but why would he get in with three other Republicans in the race?
Well, like you said, it's his last chance to make a go of it, and he would walk in with one of the healthiest campaign accounts mm-hmm. To be able to run, and it's, you know, maybe he can find a path to victory within a crowded field, but you know, even if those two folks do get in this race, North Louisiana is still wide open. Mm-hmm. We haven't heard any names from North Louisiana, so you got to wonder who would be able to move into that area. I mean, Darden and Vitter probably already have some infrastructure, political infrastructure up there. So they would probably have an early jump on it.
Well, two-thirds of the people are in South Louisiana, and it may be a case in which North Louisiana does not have anyone from that area but could determine who is the winner, no doubt, because of the electoral's power that comes with one-third of the electorate, or almost one-third. And David Vitter, like Bobby Jindal, and maybe some of the others, we may soon see him in some churches in North Louisiana.
That's right. And the interesting, too, I was thinking about this yesterday, is that most all of the candidates have a stone around their neck, except for Jay Darden. You know, Vitter has to contend with the D.C. Madam scandal. Angel's going to have to contend with Jindal. And John Bel Edwards is going to have to contend with Obama. I don't see anything on the surface that Jay Darden has to answer for.
But he's not endeared with the hard right conservative Christian people, and that's just a reality.
Yeah, and I think we have seen Darden start to move a little bit further to the right than we ever have him have seen him in his state senate election, secretary of state election. I think part of that is to answer Vitter, because Vitter is to the right of the field. I don't think anyone's going to get to the right of Vitter.
And Vitter has been sounding a bit more moderate, saying he would consider the Medicaid money, everything's on the table. If he's sincere about this being his last job, he might govern a bit differently than Governor Jindal, but I'm not so sure David Vitter has given up the ghost of being a candidate for president at some point in his life.
Maybe so, and I think those more moderate stances we're seeing from Vitter isn't a move for the center as much as it is him grasping an opportunity to run against someone or something, and that something is Bobby Jindal.
Okay, 2975633, a question for Jeremy Alford about the indictment this week of the former Secretary of Health in Louisiana, Mr. Greenstein. He has been indicted, and it's certainly not good news for him. He turned himself in yesterday, but it would seem that it's not good news for Governor Jindal.
No, you got to imagine that they're worried about this right now. And the question is, you know, if Greenstein does find himself in a bit of trouble, is he able to flip on anyone? Does he have more information to provide? But the larger theme here is that Governor Jindal is campaigning as a healthcare expert. This was certainly put a black eye on that narrative.
And Governor Jindal, his staff did not respond well to a column you wrote a few weeks ago in Law Politics questioning the decisions that he has made regarding health care. They came at you with a vengeance.
They did. They had a press release ready to go the next day after the column came out. I wasn't totally surprised by that. They did contact me the evening of Labor Day to tell me how unhappy they were. But it's interesting to see that other editorial writers around the state are kind of picking up on the same themes over the past week.
Well, and the indictment of Greenstein can't be something that serves well for those who were defending the governor, because after all, this was his handpicked choice. And I guess the question about CNSI is, when did the governor know it, and what did he know? Are his fingerprints on this contract as well?
Yeah, and that's really that's a theme in this story, are the unknowns, aside from whether Greenstein would have other information to give and whether there would be other employees pulled in to testify or be deposed. I think a lot of us forget that there was actually a federal grand jury that was launched to look into this, and we just never heard anything else about it. I interviewed one state official when the news first broke a couple weeks ago, and he suggested that maybe the feds are shadowing the state investigation. But again, that's conjecture, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, yesterday, Health Chief Bruce Greenstein, the former DHH secretary, turned himself in, and Judge Mike Irwin set a $10,000 bond. Greenstein did not have to post any security. He was allowed to go with a promise to appear in state court when required and released on his own personal recognizance. So, assuming that Bruce Greenstein will be back, he will not be born to run like Bruce Springsteen. 2975633 is your number. 877-217-5757. Back with Jeremy Alford, the editor and publisher of Law Politics. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with Jeremy Alford of Vlaam Politics. And we're 1 month and 1 day away from the November 4th election. The marquee race is the U.S. Senate one with Mary Landrieu facing Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus and others. But Cassidy is the person thought to be most likely and almost certainly to be either in first or second place, probably second place in the primary, and according to many pundits, he is the favorite to win in December. How do you see it?
I think Mary Landrieu has an uphill struggle. I think they're spending everything they have and putting their full resources behind trying to win in the primary. Rob Manus remains her best shot of winning in the primary. But if it goes to a runoff like many of us expect, it's going to be tough for her to try to catch up, whether the Republicans win the Senate or not.
Well, this is a race that the nation will be watching, and it is the only December race because of our unusual situation here. Mary Landrieu has had one other one that went to December with Susie Terrell. The Woody Jenkins runoff was in November, not December. And this time she has President Obama, who is not going to appear with her. In fact, she has disavowed any knowledge of the president for obvious reasons. He is somebody who may be popular in some parts of this country, although now that is questionable, but he's certainly not popular here.
Right. And I just want to interject because the Inkster Show is home to some of these interesting political factoids. You know, Louisiana has been promoted as having the last in the nation runoff. But actually, Georgia may require a runoff, and
that's
if
true.
It does, it's going to be January 6th, 3 days after Congress is sworn in. And it's looking like there may be a runoff. But
after hours.
Right, after hours in January. And, Mary Landrieu is continuing to have to answer for her connection to President Obama. Obviously, it hasn't helped her any in Louisiana. But, you know, I'm expecting to maybe hear a robocall or two in the last week of the campaign in the primary, because I think they're swinging for the fences to win in the primary, and because they know that the runoff is going to be tough. And the National Republican Senatorial Committee has already spent $3.4 million reserving time in the runoff, and a super PAC just came forward and did the same thing in Louisiana over the past week.
Well, Mary Landrieu will face perhaps the sternest of four challenges, and the last three have not been easy, particularly the first one with Woody Jenkins, 5,788 votes. She won that race because she carried New Orleans by 100,000 votes. And Bill Clinton that day helped her a lot, but he won the presidential election in Louisiana by 215,000 votes. She could not have won without his help. My guess is we might see him sometime in November or December or both. But Bill Cassidy is largely running his campaign on television. He's decided that he will make what, quote, safe appearances and spend a lot of money on television and hope that the tide is such that he can get in by virtue of having an R behind his name. That may be enough.
Yeah, and he's really running the incumbent's campaign. He's only agreed to two of five planned debates this month. He's still being outspent on TV 2-1 by Democrats and Mary Landrieu. But that 100,000 vote pickup in New Orleans, I think Landrieu comes out the gate with that lead. And I think the Cassidy campaign is focused on two important regions, the first being St. Tammany and Tangipahoa. It was the first field office the Republicans opened up outside of Baton Rouge this cycle. Cassidy has an extensive field operation there. It's an area that has largely been suburbanized over the past generation. It used to be kind of run by the courthouse gang, and the party's eager to get in there and figure out what makes it tick, because their margins of victory there have been very thin. Mm-hmm. The other region being Acadiana, they want to turn it out big, and it could be sort of a swing area for the Senate race.
Here's a question from Henry at the Country Club. He says, last night I was polled by somebody regarding the Senate, the 6th Congressional District, and governor, and the first time I've ever been polled when Mitch Landrieu was included. I don't know if that's any particular surprise.
No, he's been polled before in scenarios for the governor's race, and in both of those instances, they showed him making the runoff with Vitter.
Okay. Here's a question from Jack in Bocage. What does Jeremy think about the Stephanie Grace article this morning on the 6th Congressional District. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah, I think she brings up some interesting points, which is, and this is a story that I'm working on next week for subscribers of La Politics Weekly. This week we took a close look at the Terrebonne Lafourche area, which makes up about 11% of the electorate in the 6th. East Baton Rouge makes up about 17%. Dan Clater's entire Senate district lies within that area. So I think he may have a statistical advantage if his voters turn out for him. But you got to wonder how much of that 17% is actually going to go vote, how much of it is black versus white, Republican versus Democrat. And Baton Rouge is top heavy in this race. I mean, we have Garrett Graves, we have Paul Dietzel, Cassie Felder, Edwin Edwards, obviously. So there are several Republicans in this race. So I think, if Dan Clater can manage to not allow Baton Rouge to get completely carved up, he'll have the advantage. But if it is carved up thoroughly and the bottom part of the district is carved up thoroughly, I think Ascension and Livingston Parishes are the swing.
Mm-hmm. How has Garrett Graves raised so much money?
Garrett Graves has raised a good deal of money from the Republican establishment. He actually has money from the Koch brothers directly, not any of their little PACs that they fund from kind of behind the scenes, but actually from the Koch brothers PAC. He's also made a really strong push early on to get money from the shipbuilders and the contractors along the coast, and he has a pretty good fundraising team set up as well.
Mm-hmm. A few weeks ago, you wrote that in a state where politics is theater, we may be running short on thespians. What's going on?
That's maybe the scariest headline I've ever written. there are 24 races around the state that drew no candidates whatsoever. These are completely empty ballots. Candidates may actually have to be recruited for these races. A new round of qualifying called. Another 100 or so elections had candidates either withdraw or candidates disqualified. And then 75% of the judicial races on the ballot this cycle were given to judges or candidates because they faced no opposition. I think it's troublesome. I think we need a competitive process to get the best and brightest candidates into office. And when you have people not showing up for races or people being unopposed on a level like this, it turns election contest into overnight conquest. And I think that is troublesome.
Question from a listener. Mitt Romney's raising money tonight for Bill Cassidy. Does Mitt Romney have relevance in Louisiana?
Well, he can bring some money in, I think. Mm-hmm. And he did. Yeah. And he did perform here in the last election. But, he's definitely not alone. Bill Clinton was in New Orleans at Tableau not long ago raising money for Mary Landrieu.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to have some visits, but as I said, I'd be very surprised if President Obama is anywhere near Louisiana.
I am too. That's why I think robocalls to select phone numbers in the last week of the primary may be the only time we hear from him.
Well, it'll be fascinating to watch, and we'll be following it with Jeremy, and look forward to another visit from you soon. Thank you, Jeremy Alford.
I do. Thanks.
Take care. We're joined in studio now by another member of the A-Team. We go from Alford to Anderson, as in Andy Anderson, the financial analyst who has been with us. And obviously the market has been a topsy-turvy one of late. What's going on Wall Street?
Well, this is really an exciting time. We are in a bull market. This bull market got going in January of 2012. Now, remember, bull markets are 10 to 20-year phenomenons. Jim, one of the things that I would really point out that's going on right now is the new issues that are coming out in the last quarter, and I view this as a window of opportunity for investing right now that our listeners really need to be paying attention to. There have been several companies go public here in the last, say, 10 weeks that look very, very promising.
Several companies have gone public, but you have pulled a lot of cash to the side, haven't you?
Yes, we're very heavy in cash because we want to be in a position to take on the risk of these IPOs. We actually bought two this morning.
So how do you get in on an IPO?
Well, we're not getting in on the actual initial price offering. We are watching. We look for what we call an IPO base, which is once a company goes public, we'll watch it for a minimum of 3 weeks, up to 10 weeks. if the stock does not melt down, meaning like over a 15% drop, which usually means that the insiders are, you know, the founders are dumping their positions, if we see that, we avoid. Now, that's what happened with Facebook, and that's also what happened with Twitter. But we're seeing some other issues that are coming out here recently that are really getting our attention.
297-5633 for financial analyst BF Andy Anderson. And the market has not performed as well this year as in the last few. And why?
Well, what's going on is Europe is incredibly slow. In fact, their markets, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, really look as if they're going into bear markets. So what's happening with the world economy is Europe is just really not doing well. This is causing problems for the China market. The Chinese market has really dropped here recently. So basically what's happening is that the fear is the dominant emotion. But as I always tell people who understand behavioral finance, you need to have greed when there's fear, and you need to have fear when there's greed.
Well, many people get it the other way around, but it is an inexact process, even for professionals like Mr. Andy Anderson, who does this for a living and has for many, many years. Now, the Ebola scare, I was reading in USA Today yesterday that this could affect the market, particularly anything involving travel.
Airline stocks have taken a fairly decent hit. We've been following Southwest Airlines as one of our primary ideas. That stock did take a hit on the Ebola scare. It's just something to watch closely.
And what about all this turbulence around the world? That can't be good for the market.
No, it's not good. It creates the fear. It creates the uncertainty. But, you know, it's something that hopefully we'll just muddle on through. The main concern I have is Germany and France right now as far as international markets. They just don't look good.
Now, Andy has been ranked very highly among his peers in his performance over the last couple of years, and largely a lot of that has to do with Tesla. What have you done with Tesla?
We went ahead and sold Tesla. Now realize, you know, Tesla basically put my son through college. It's been a wonderful, wonderful investment. We originally found the stock around 27, didn't buy it due to a Joe Broder report in New York Times, which was turned out to be a fictitious report. We ended up buying the stock around 56. We got up to, I want to say close to 300, around 290. We decided to go ahead and take the profit because we have found something else that is Tesla related that we're quite excited about.
Can you talk about it?
I'm going to mention it. It's a company called Mobileye. They just went public 10 weeks ago. It's one we bought this morning. Now, we found this stock really around 36. We bought it this morning around 57. It's breaking out. It's trading right now at 59.5. It's up 8% today. They are involved in autonomous driving technology. You see, the key to this whole ball game is you've got to get involved in these companies when they're early. This is approximately a $10 billion company. Now, if you look at something like an Alibaba, which went public here recently, that went public at $200 billion. Tesla is currently, I want to say, about $30 billion. I believe your old friend Apple, what's that up to, about $500 billion now?
$600 billion.
Seven. Well, you know, it's really the question here is, and I gave you that checklist for a reason, is there's just certain things you got to look for. And these things are rare. They're very, very rare. So we only have three stocks in our portfolio right now, of which all are new issues that came out within the last year.
And they are?
Facebook, which we've done extremely well on. We started buying Facebook at 36. It's now trading around 78, 79. We also bought this morning, we bought Twitter. Twitter had a very difficult IPO. They had some problems with insider selling, but that seems to be abated now. We took a position on Twitter this morning. They've got 250 million users. We think there's a chance within the next 3 to 5 years that they could go to 600,000, 700,000 users.
600 million, right?
I'm sorry, 600 million. I'm sorry. Yeah. Hold on. Facebook is 1.3 billion users. Twitter would be 600,000 users.
I think more than that.
More than that.
600 million, I think. in the next few years.
Well,
but the other one, the one you mentioned that you say you got into today, what's the symbol for that one?
Symbol is MBLY. Now, look, this stuff is risky. There's no getting around it. But the technology is being quickly adapted. In fact, I was my good friend Joe Tregel just bought a new Audi A7, which has this technology. And if you really want to hear somebody talk about it, talk to Joe, because he is just amazed by how amazing this is. Johnson & Johnson did a study of about 60,000 vehicles with this technology. It improved their safety by 30%. They said the only car that got hit during the test, which was a six-month test, the only car that got hit was one in a parking lot.
Well, when you sold your Tesla stock, did you sell your car as well?
I sold my car as well.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. I'll tell you what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned that the electric car thing could be a sizzle and fizzle thing. I'm a little concerned about it. I'm watching it. It's definitely on my radar, but I think there's a lot of risk at this point and at this price. So I just went ahead and took my profit. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Facebook. You say you got it at 36 and it's at 70.
It's at 78 right now.
78. When it first was available, it didn't do as well as anticipated. What's caused this?
Well, it came out as a $100 billion offering. The insiders, it was too hyped. They hyped it up too much. I could see it. I had way too many phone calls from clients wanting in on the deal, and it just kind of got my attention. So I realized that it had been hyped way too much. I kind of think Alibaba looks similar, in fact. I think there's just too much interest in the offering, and therefore the price was somewhat dilutive, and too many shares came out.
Now, what happens with the election? Does that have any impact on the market?
I'm certain that there is. I've never seen really any reason to think that the president or any one man can affect the stock market. But I will say that the Republicans tend to promote war more than the Democrats. Therefore, wars are bad. That's not good. The other thing, too, is that if you're a believer in the velocity of money, which means that you've got to get money into the hands of people who spend money, the Democrats tend to be more in that camp. Now, I'm not preaching socialism. What I'm preaching is that in order to make money like a Walmart, you've got to have people coming in the door that have money.
297-5633. We'll stay with Andy Anderson for a bit longer, and this has been a year in which the market's been all over the place, up and down and back and forth, and right now it's up today, but of late it hasn't been going up.
You know, this creates a real opportunity. We are in a bull market. What we're having is a correction. If the market just goes up, 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 up all the time, you get yourself in a situation where you could set up for a market crash, such as we had in 87. So basically, we're in a correction within a bull market, but use this opportunity as a way to find companies that are holding up well in this environment.
We shall return in 90 seconds with more from Andy Anderson, and we're slated to hear from Catherine Patterson, the two-time National Book Award winner. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. In a few minutes, we'll hear from the renowned author, Catherine Patterson. Andy Anderson with us for a few more minutes. Jeff on I-10. Good morning, Jeff. You're on the air with Andy.
Yes, sir. I was wondering, what do you think about the price of silver and other precious metals?
Can I answer that?
Yeah.
We're of the opinion that gold and metals and commodities should be avoided at this time. We're seeing a bear market in that group. Price of oil broke $100 a barrel just yesterday. I would really avoid the metals at this time and commodities.
But you invest strictly in stocks?
I'm basically in stock. I'm in growth stocks. I'm looking for the next Walmart.
Mm-hmm. So right now, as far as cash to stocks, how do you stand?
I'm about 75% cash right now.
And why?
But I'm looking to buy.
Why?
Because I'm looking to buy. These new IPOs that came out in the last quarter should be bought, but I'm waiting for the right time.
All right. MBLY is the one you bought today.
Well, just so you, one other thing I want to mention to you is that Mobileye's chips will be available in 140 car models by the end of this year and grow to 237 models by 2016. The projected growth rate on this company is phenomenal.
And you don't sell short?
No, it's just not something I'm interested in.
Well, some people would never have that kind of cash. They would either buy or sell short.
The problem with going short is it's limited. You can only make so much money. With something like a mobile eye, you know, my intention is to make 10 times my money. Whereas when you short a stock, I mean, it's a trading strategy. It's not an investing strategy. It's just, it's limited. You know, there's a lot of investments out there that I find are just a waste of time. It's not that they're bad or good. It's just a waste of time. I'm 60 years old now, and I've got so much time to make it happen. So, you know, Warren Buffett was 60 years old. He was born in 1930. He was 60 years old when he found Coca-Cola, which is his biggest win. So he didn't hit his biggest win till he was 60. Well, that's what I'm going to do.
And John Wooden didn't win his first national championship until he was 53. And by the time he was 64, he'd won 10 of them. So Andy feels like he's in the prime of life. But the market is uncertain. We never know how it's going to go. But you feel confident that it's going to be a bull market. Have you ever predicted a bear market?
Look, I started in this business in 1976. The market was at 600. I watched this thing go up 16,000 points. So I'm going to tend to be an optimist. But look, I'm a realist as well. I'm 75% cash right now because I was concerned about this correction. But what I do in corrections is I'm looking for stocks that are holding up well during the correction because that tells me where the next leadership is going to be.
Well, Andy, we thank you as always. Any parting thoughts?
Basically, we're in a bull market. Get over the fear. You've got to invest.
Thank you, sir. We're joined now by Catherine Patterson. Teachers, writers, and fans of young author fiction, young and old alike, are invited to the East Baton Rouge Parish Library's 37th Annual Author Illustrator Program, and this year it features our guest. Catherine Patterson is the winner of two National Book Awards. She wrote such works as The Great Gilly Hopkins and Jacob I Have Loved, and she will be talking about writing for a young audience, and the evening is free, open to the public, and on the first day of the program, 7 p.m. Thursday, October 9th, we will hear from our guest, Catherine Patterson. Good morning. Catherine?
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Beautiful. Now, you were born in China.
I was born in China.
And when did you come this way?
Well, I came to the States twice. Once when I was 5 years old, and we were here for a year, and then the situation in China seemed to calm down, so we were able to go back to China, but fairly quickly, by the end of 1940, the continent was beginning to order families out of China again.
And your first language was not English.
Well, I started speaking Chinese and English about the same time. They said Chinese was a little ahead of the English. But I have a letter from my father to his mother when I was not quite two, and apparently I couldn't be shut up in either language by that time.
But your father was a missionary, right?
My parents were missionaries, yes.
Yeah, and that's why you were in China. That must have been a remarkable upbringing for you.
Well, as I've often said, I didn't have one to compare it with. It seemed quite normal to me because it was the only childhood I had. But I think of myself as having a fairly idyllic childhood until the war, World War II began. And, of course, in China, that began in 1937. So you can do the math and see that I'm an elderly person.
Well, you were about 5 years old. How was the war experience in China?
It was terrifying for a child, as you can imagine, and made more terrifying because my father was allowed to go back to our hometown, and we had to stay where it was considered to be safer, although you know, there were bombs and blackouts of the windows every night, and between us and where our father was, there was a good deal of fighting, both between the Chinese and the Japanese, but the communists were in there too, and lots of bandits, so it was a very dangerous country, and we never knew if our father was safe or not, so that was always frightening.
It truly was a world war.
It was a world war.
Hmm. Do you ever feel in danger?
Oh, yes. There's a rather terrifying story from my childhood. We were on the summer of 1940. We were in the port city of Qingdao, and the Japanese had already occupied it, but they were practicing maneuvers on the beach every day. They told my father they were practicing for San Francisco, and we were not supposed to be on the beach during the afternoon. And somehow I was out there with my little sister, who was three, I was six, and suddenly I heard this horrifying cry, and I saw just an army of men dressed only in loincloths with their bayonet sticks come racing up the beach. And I grabbed my little sister's hand and ran as fast as I could to the house. I think I had my eyes closed when I ran, but it was pretty terrifying for me.
I would imagine so. How did that experience shape your later life and make you the writer that you are?
Well, the interesting thing is that when I was a young adult, I lived in Japan for 4 years. And if anybody had told me when I was 9 years old that I would go to live in Japan, I wouldn't have visited. The Japanese were the enemy, and I feared and I hated them, really. And I had a friend in graduate school who persuaded me that if I would give the Japanese people a chance, that I would come to love them. And it really happened. I've often said I think everybody should have the experience of being loved by people that you thought you hated. I think it changed the world.
Well, your characters often prevail and triumph and redeem themselves and their ambitions. That I would think has something to do with how you grew up.
Well, it's the only life I've had, and I'm sure in the case of any writer, it's your own life that shapes your writing. And I'm very grateful for the life I've had. I think it's been a rather wonderful life to have lived. I'm not responsible for that. That's a gift to me, and certainly it shapes my writing.
And you started with a career in the Presbyterian Church. How did this evolution, if you will, occur for you to become the writer that you did become?
Well, I never really expected to be a writer. I was a reader. I loved to read. But I knew what good writing was. I wasn't going to be a writer.
Uh-huh.
But this a professor I had when I was in seminary asked me if I'd ever thought of being a writer. And I said, oh, no, I wouldn't want to add another mediocre writer to the world. And she said, well, maybe that's what God is calling you to be. And I couldn't imagine God wanted a whole lot of mediocre writers, but she was the one who got me my first writing job. And after I did that, I thought, well, I've got all these little children. I'm not going back to school teaching anytime soon, so maybe I'll be a writer. It took me 7 years to publish my first novel.
1966, the novel Who Am I?
Now, that's not the novel. That's the book I wrote for the Presbyterian Church. And the novel, the first novel was The Sign of the Chrysanthemum
In 73, so you were 41 years old.
Yeah. I was.
Yeah, so that
late bloomer.
And you're 82 now, so that's half a lifetime ago for you.
That's right.
But some people believe that the best creative works occur when people are in their 20s. Obviously, for you, that was not the case.
I didn't start in my 20s.
Yeah. Well, you won not one, but two National Book Awards. Next to the Pulitzer, that's probably the greatest honor a writer can receive. How was that experience?
Well, I must say that I was really naughty the second time, because Tim O'Brien, who won the same time I went for Great Gilly Hopkins, he said, "Oh, Catherine, aren't you terrified?" And I said, "Well, Tim, it's a little easier the second time." I think he restrained himself from hitting me. But
yeah, well, there aren't many doubles.
You know, the first time you're just totally overwhelmed, and then the second time you can sort of sit back and enjoy it. So I recommend second awards to everybody.
Well, what will you convey at your appearance here?
Well, read to your children, read yourself, and talk about what you've read. I think, you know, one thing that's happening to us is that we don't read intensively and thoughtfully, and therefore we have a hard time understanding other people, and we think in sound bites, and we don't gain the wisdom mm-hmm. that real intensive reading helps you gain. And I think that's one reason our country is in kind of a mess right now. We don't know how to listen to each other. We don't know how to respect each other's differences. And I learned a lot about other people by reading books. And mm-hmm. in World War II, I read a book about Soviet children, and I thought, how can you hate somebody you've made friends with? And you make friends through books. You begin to care about people who are different from yourself.
The remarkable Catherine Peterson will be in Baton Rouge on the 9th and 10th. She'll be speaking, and then the 10th, there will be a half-day workshop, and there is a fee charge for this one. And if you would like to find out more, you can go to the website for the library online, ebrpl.com, or you may call 225-231-3760, 225-231-3760. Catherine Patterson says, reading can be a road to freedom or a key to a secret garden, which if tended will transform all of life. With all our gadgets today, are we reading less?
Yes, probably so. People say, well, what about children? And of course, if I go to talk to children, it's because their teacher is concerned that they be readers. And I have 7 grandchildren, and they all have all the gadgets, but they are also readers. But that's because they come from homes where books are valued, and their parents read, and their parents have read to them, and they know what books can do that a gadget can't. And that's what we need to help our children understand.
You say, I am constantly writing autobiography, but I have to turn it into fiction in order to give it credibility.
Well, people always ask me if I put real people into books, and I said, well, real people are unbelievable. You have to put believable people into books.
Well, we look forward to your visit, and you have a lot to impart. You've lived quite a life. Lived in China during World War II and in harm's way. As a child, that had to be just a searing experience.
Well, my children always wanted me to read horror books, and I said I was scared enough by the time I was 8 years old. I don't need to read anything else to scare me. So I'm glad that part of my life is behind me those few years.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, and look
well,
forward
thank you
to
for
your
having
visit
me. It's delightful to talk to you, Jim.
Well, thank you, Catherine. Appreciate it. And we'll be back Monday, but since I said some of the quotes from Catherine Patterson, I'll mention one that is in law politics from Jeremy Alford, from former Governor Edwin Edwards. He commented on Ray Nagin's first days in prison, saying the loudest sound you're going to hear is the clanging of a prison door when you walk in for the first time. And Edwin Edwards is likely to run first. After spending 8.5 years in prison, he's likely to be the biggest vote getter on November 4th, 1 month and 1 day away in the 6th Congressional District, and then we'll see who he is in the runoff with, and he will be a decided underdog in that race. But the Cajun Prince, in all his trips to the post and primaries and general elections, he's only run second once, and that was in 1987 when he lost the governor's race to Charles Elson Buddy Romer, who will turn 71 years old tomorrow. We wish former Governor Romer well. He recently had a mild stroke, but has come back well. I saw him at the Don McLean concert. And Henson Moore, former congressman from this area, former high-ranking official in the first Bush administration, chief of staff at one point. He is 75 years old tomorrow. Remember 1986 when he and John Breaux ran against each other? Breaux was 42 and Henson Moore was not much older, and that was a long time ago. Back Monday. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.